It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. Monday marks the third anniversary of the deadly mass shooting at Sandy Hook Elementary School in Newtown, Connecticut. In the aftermath of that tragic event, Pennsylvania Congressman Tim Murphy helped launch a top-to-bottom review of the country's mental health system beginning in January of 2013, which has led to his developing a bill targeting mental health treatment and awareness throughout the United States, which he says is a major contributor to this kind of violent crime. Congressman Murphy joins us by phone now from Washington to discuss the progress of the Helping Families in Mental Health Crisis Act of 2015 and his hopes for the future of mental health care. Congressman Murphy, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
It's good to be with you. Thank you.
And you can join the conversation with your comments and questions for Congressman Murphy by calling 412-246-2002. That's 412-246-2002. Email is esspgh@wesa.fm and on Twitter at esspgh. Again, the number 412-246-2002. Congressman Murphy, as you've spent the last 3 years taking a hard look at the country's mental health system, you have identified a number of problems. What are the ones that concern you the most?
Well, in the area of mental health, what we found is a large number of barriers the federal government actually places in the way of people getting help who have serious mental illness. Now, bear in mind that we're talking here about 60 million Americans in any given year may have some diagnosable mental illness, from the very mild to very severe. But among those with serious mental illness, particularly persistent mental illness, now we're talking about 10 million or so. And about 4 million of those are in no treatment at all. And when a person with serious mental illness, and here we're talking things like schizophrenia, bipolar illness, and others, a person with serious mental illness who is not in any treatment is 15 times more likely to be violent than a person who is in treatment. And yet the federal government has several barriers for them getting care. These include such things as Medicaid won't pay for someone to see two doctors in the same day at the same practice. Medicaid won't pay for a person who has a need for inpatient psychiatric hospitalization if the hospital has more than 16 beds. A lot of the grants that have been given out in the area of mental health have really been more for health than investigating illnesses. And so we have had federal dollars, mass amounts of federal dollars, go for such things as buying paintings that decorate the walls and at some of the office buildings, to $426,000 going for a website of sing-along songs for three-year-olds, to forums on how to do art on your pillowcase to help you dream better at night, to, the list goes on, yoga, massage, and the list goes on and on. And what we found is we're spending a lot of money. We have a lot of programs. We have 112 federal programs that deal with mental illness, but they're not coordinated and they're not working. And these are coordinated to General Accounting Office audits of the federal agencies. So from that, we thought, no wonder we are having these problems. We create so many barriers for family members to help anymore. We don't have enough facilities. We've shut down the hospitals. States haven't followed through with community supports. It's no wonder we have more homelessness. We have people who are victims of violence or perpetrators of violence. We have prisons that are 40 to 60% of the inmates are people with untreated mental illness. So it's a pretty dismal state of affairs, and that's why we introduced a bill to rewrite this system to overcome these problems and change our mental health system in America.
And how do you see, Congressman Murphy, mental health care and these mass shootings intersecting, not just what happened at Newtown 3 years ago, but certainly what happened in San Bernardino last week in Colorado on Thanksgiving weekend, and these types of incidents?
Well, there's a wide range here. When you see mass shootings, you're probably talking about three different categories. You're talking about some that may be, they're just criminal activity, gang violence, drug violence, criminal activity. That's one type. Second type are acts of terrorism. We can talk about those. And third type is someone who is mentally ill, untreated or undertreated, perhaps hearing hallucinations and delusions telling them to go do something, or their paranoia from their misinterpretation of what reality is that guides them towards this, takes some action. And my bill addresses more that third category. That's about 10% of the shootings out there. but there's probably overlap. I'm sure there's overlap in the criminal activities and there's overlap in the terrorist activities because some terrorist groups really try and recruit people who may be mentally unstable towards taking their action. And our bill basically begins with getting services to people with mental illness and making it easier to get them. I mean, the problem is if you're a minority or if you're in a low-income area, your chances of having access to treatment are much, much lower. Many times insurance plans will pay for it, but even though we passed mental health parity laws, they are not. It makes it very difficult to access. And we don't have enough psychiatrists, psychologists, social workers. The places aren't often easy to get to, so it's no wonder why the tragedy is that many minorities find that for their similar problems, they may be arrested. They may end up in other struggles. And then once they may have been arrested for even minor crimes, a person who is mentally ill versus a person who is not mentally ill, that mentally ill person may end up serving a sentence that's four times longer, to a large extent because they may get in fights in prison, they may be abused by other prisoners, may get into altercations with prison guards.
And they're also not getting treatment, are they? They're also not getting treatment when they're in prison.
Yes, exactly right. In fact, some prisons will actually take away if they're on medication. About 80% of the time, though, they're not in any treatment. And then because of that, the situation just becomes downright abusive, where people may be put into solitary confinement, tasers against them more. It's pretty brutal. In fact, action was taken against the state of Pennsylvania to stop putting people with mental illness in solitary confinement. Still, they're not getting access to care. And look, if someone serves the crime, they've got to do the time. But the issue is that if it is because they're so severely mentally ill, they're hearing voices commanding them to do things, or their understanding of reality is so problematic that they continue to get in trouble, we ought to be making treatment accessible to them and not just jails accessible to them.
412-246-2002 to join our conversation with Pennsylvania Congressman Tim Murphy. We have James from the South Side on the line. James, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Hey, hello. Hello, Mr. Murphy.
Hello, James.
I just want to say congratulations. You did a good job since you've been in office. I voted for you, and I think you're doing a great job. I'm an ex-employee of the Department of Homeland Security. I actually left in 2013. And I wonder if you was aware, listeners are aware, that Sandy Hook didn't happen. It was a hoax. It was a false flag.
Nobody okay, well, asked. Thanks very much. Not true.
Yeah, James, I'm sorry. I'm sorry about that, Congressman.
That's okay. But, you know, but it does bring up a point here that, you know, in America, people can are entitled to their opinions. They're not entitled to their facts. But that does bring up a point. So let's just look at that, how sometimes people will have their own perceptions of reality. I'll be meeting with some folks later today who are involved with Sandy Hook. I have met the parents. I keep the pictures of the children in my office who died from that day. I have talked to other family members from other tragedies. I've talked to people at schools and communities where there have been other tragedies. These are real. These are not made up events by a government that is trying to take our rights away. But think about that. When someone does go down that direction with those kind of thought processes, and I'm not saying that happened in the case of this person, but if those thoughts then go into the mind of someone whose memory, understanding, comprehension, encoding, decoding of information, perception drives them towards some action, now you've got someone who is has a potential for serious problems. I'd much rather have a review to see, can we get this person treatment and help them? But unfortunately, our country changed the laws a while ago. It's gotten worse, but much of it is based in 18th century thought that you can't make a person go into treatment unless they are on the verge of killing themselves or someone else. And I think that in our goal to protect someone's rights, we actually protected the right to be sick and not the right to be well.
412-246-2002. Let's try Kevin from Pittsburgh. Hi, Kevin. You're on with Congressman Murphy.
Congressman Murphy.
Hello, Kevin.
I'm calling. I appreciate the sudden attention that government officials are placing on the needs and of treatment for the mentally ill. But I'm wondering why we're suddenly stigmatizing the mentally ill as though they're the problem, whenever there are a lot more guns and a lot more weapons. And the problem is easy access and proliferation of such deadly and necessary weapons. There are a lot more guns out on the streets and there are mentally ill people on the streets. The problem is the large amount of guns. What are you doing about that?
Well, I can't take care of everything, but I am as the only practicing mental health professional in the federal government. It's me. I'm a caucus of one. I'm a psychologist. I've worked with this for 40 years. I've written two books on the areas of anger. One's called The Angry Child, another book called Overcoming Passive Aggression. I'm currently a Navy commander. I'm a psychologist in the Navy, and there I work with soldiers with post-traumatic stress disorder and with traumatic brain injury. I deal with a lot of folks where we have to do security and safety assessments of these issues. I don't have a cure for cancer. I don't have a cure for everything. But I do know that for these millions of Americans suffering from serious mental illness, I am focused on getting our country to change. And I'm calling attention to those things that people don't want to pay attention to. It's uncomfortable for us to have our nice world shattered by someone like me who is saying that America is a mess, that we have ignored this, that we have wanted to just push the mentally ill back in the shadows or back in asylums or step over them in the street when they're homeless and lying there. And I don't want to do that anymore. And so this is what I put my focus into. I will not stop every act of violence with this legislation. But I know we will stop many. We will, by getting people early identification and treatment, by recognizing that half of serious mental illness emerges by age 14 and about 75% by age 24. And yet that's the key time when we stop providing services. Kids leave high school. They drop out of school. No one provides service anymore. At the very time when their brains are changing from genetic triggers or whatever to set this person off, where under the wrong circumstances, these people can become violent towards themselves or someone else. And quite frankly, it's much more often they're violent towards themselves with suicide. We've got to stop this as a nation. And that's what I'm focused on. But I can't cure everything. But I know this is one very, very important group of 10 million Americans that we've got, we can do something about. And when I look at things like what happened at Sandy Hook or Aurora, Colorado or Tucson or Oregon, you pick the city, pick the place, many of those situations would have been prevented if we had been providing care for that person.
And you have mentioned your mental health background, your decades as a psychologist, and you have done a lot of work in the trenches, so to speak. How has that informed your efforts, Congressman Murphy, as an advocate for change in the U.S. mental health care system?
Well, it's affected it because these are things that I've been deeply involved with from the time when I first started seeing patients early in my career, and I began to realize, wait a minute, the system is blocking us from helping people. Psychiatry and psychology is the only field of health care that's oftentimes defined by attorneys and not by science. And so we have people who will actually, what I said before, we want to protect someone's right to be sick instead of advocating for the right to be well. But it's also my understanding of that schizophrenia and bipolar illness, these are not attitudes. Now, half a century ago, people used to blame the mother or the father or say that they would call it the refrigerator mom or the schizophrenogenic mother or the other environmental circumstances. We did not even understand how a person with serious mental illness understands the world differently. They even see things differently. Optometrists and ophthalmologists, perception studies can even say they actually see the world differently. They hear the world differently because it is a brain disease. We can understand this a little bit better when we talk about someone with Alzheimer's or dementia. We would never tolerate seeing an 80-year-old woman walking the streets of Pittsburgh or anywhere in America barefoot in a January day, wearing just a bathrobe, because we'd say there's something wrong with her, let's get her help. And yet, all the time we will drive by a homeless, mentally ill man under the same conditions thinking he's crazy, just ignore him. That to me is immoral. And now the federal government has done a lot. We have 26 homeless programs in America. We spend a lot of money there, but it's not going towards treatment of individuals. And so it's because of those experiences that I have in working with thousands of patients over the years that I've tried to take that information. Now, the problem is, I've got to admit, helping members of Congress understand what we're talking about. I've not come across any members of Congress who don't believe we should do something to change areas of mental illness. But it is helping them to understand the facts of the science that has sometimes been a hurdle. They care deeply. I'm not criticizing any of my colleagues, but they care deeply. But understanding these the issues behind it has sometimes been problematic. So if I say, for example, in the HIPAA laws, that's our privacy and confidentiality laws, currently if, let's say you have a family member who was 22 years old, gets taken to the hospital in the middle of the night by the police, and you're saying, where's my brother? What happened to him? You call in the hospital, we can't tell you. They may release him at 2 in the morning, saying, okay, you're not going to kill yourself, but whatever you were brought here by the police for, just go take care of yourself. Take this medicine, see a doctor. If that person is still in the midst of the delirium or delusions, but not necessarily going to kill anybody at that moment, we're dumping them back onto the street, but the HIPAA law says you can't tell a family member. Or many times a person with serious mental illness has other medical problems, diabetes, cardiovascular disease, lung disease, infections. And a family member can say, hey, can you at least tell me when his next appointment is so I can help get him there, because he forgets everything? And right now the doctor says, no, we can't even tell you that. Part of what my bill wants to do is allow that compassionate communication between a doctor and a family member, a caregiver, or a spouse. Say, listen, this is the prescription, or here's his next appointment, or he's got serious diabetes. Could you make sure he sees an endocrinologist? That's a problem with the system, and I'm trying to help my colleagues understand that that's not interfering with someone's privacy. That's actually, the current system interferes with their health. And it is that experience and what I've learned and the many patients I've taken care of over the years, and I'm trying to help other members of Congress understand.
And are they getting the message, Congressman Murphy? Are they hearing what you're saying? And I sense some level of frustration for you in trying to help your colleagues understand.
Yeah, it is frustrating, because there are some groups that are born out of those that, for the right reasons, helped shut down our asylums. They were snake pits. They were awful. I'd worked in some of those. And they were built, perhaps by the right reasons, in the 1800s and the 1920s, as a way of helping people have some respite. But we packed them. We overpacked them. We had places that were built for a few hundred people, and we packed in a few thousand. And then during World War II, when many doctors and nurses went off to war, they were overcrowded and understaffed. Abuses were rampant. We needed to fight for those rights of people to get out of those situations. But what happened was we didn't fight for their rights to get treatment. And then it morphed into an issue of never have anybody under any circumstances be compelled into treatment and never tell a family member. But that was based upon the old belief, never tell family members because they were to blame. We know that's not the case now. We know from reports made in the summer of 2014 that they've identified 108 genetic markers of schizophrenia, of bipolar illness. We're farther along understanding the genetic code for autism. So shouldn't we be saying, hey, if we can identify these folks early, let's get them help early, because we know, research tells us, when family members, loving family members are involved, and when you get to people early on, you make a world of difference in their prognosis. But where we are with mental illness, we treat this as the unwelcome child here, that we're not going to do anything until you say you're going to kill someone. And that means we are waiting until their brain deteriorates, and yes, there's real neurological deterioration that takes place. We are pushing it off and saying, we're not going to do anything until you are that bad. And that's my frustration, that some groups are saying, we're going to fight for people's rights to say no. And I'm thinking, that's not the right thing. Would we do the same thing for cancer? Like, well, we know you're stage one cancer, or we know people in your family have breast cancer, but we're not going to do anything until you're in stage four. I want to do this before stage four. But there were some groups sending misinformation. Of course, many have not even read my bill. And that's getting to some members of Congress, and they're not understanding this. And that's some of my frustration.
And that's certainly a great analogy, the cancer analogy that you just made. It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. My guest is Pennsylvania Congressman Tim Murphy. And we are talking about his Helping Families in Mental Health Crisis Act of 2015 and his hopes for the future of mental health care. So, Congressman, before we get to calls, and we've got quite a few people that would like to speak with you, what it sounds to me like you're saying is that we have eliminated a lot of the bad approaches to mental health care, but that those approaches have not been replaced by anything better or more effective. So my question to you would be, what does comprehensive reform look like?
Well, it means that we lift that 16-bed limit from Medicaid, and our bill says if there's an average length of stay in the hospital of less than 21 days, good. We're not turning them to permanent places. But many times a person with mental illness needs 2 to 3 weeks to stabilize off their old medication and on to better ones. We demand that there is a discharge plan. So when that person goes out of the hospital or, quite frankly, goes out of jail, there's a plan in place. We say that for those people who have need to see two doctors in the same day, perhaps a family physician identifies someone and saying, we think these behaviors are because these are signs of mental illness, we need to get to see someone right now. We lift that cap so they can see a psychiatrist or psychologist. We also say that in cases where a person is in that revolving door of jail and hospitals, rather than just lock them up again, for states that have a law in the books that says that a judge can, after reviewing due process, can say this person would benefit from remaining in outpatient care as opposed to inpatient, that we provide some funding to help communities do that if they've already got the law in place. We make sure that the grants and the research is and the federal agents working on this are coordinated together, that they're using scientific standards and not just a buddy system or who you know. It's blindly reviewed by scientists. These are some of the many, many changes we are making in this. Some of them people would wonder, well, gosh, I didn't even understand it was such a mess. But it is, and just to make it more effective and coordinated. But a very important point, too, is we don't have enough, as I said before, psychiatrists and psychologists. And that is a critical shortage. So of a child and adolescent psychiatrist, and bear in mind what I said before, that these symptoms emerge between ages 14 and 24. And yet, if we only have 9,000 child and adolescent psychiatrists, and we need 30,000, and we don't have anywhere near hospital beds, and we need another 60,000, there is just no way we can get people to those that need it. And then, if you're looking at rural communities, it's almost totally absent. There's places in my district, like Greene County, they don't even have a child psychiatrist there. And there's many other counties in Pennsylvania, the same thing. So we provide a mechanism to get more out there. Telemedicine, telepsychiatry, so psychologists, psychiatrists, social workers can provide consultation and counseling, even if they're not in the same area. These are some of the many areas where we're going to make it easier access by qualified people to give high-quality care out there. Just imagine if we said we didn't have any cancer care centers around. There was no heart surgery places in Pittsburgh. We would be aghast at that. But believe me, that's the status when it comes to serious mental illness. There's very few places in southwestern Pennsylvania and not enough in America that where you can really deal with these effectively.
Let's go to the phones at 412-246-2002, starting with Todd in Beaver County. Todd, hi, you're on with Congressman Murphy.
Thank you. Congressman Murphy, thank you very much for your efforts in this area.
Sure.
There's a big need to transform the system. But one of my question is basically that we haven't heard you address, and I know you're thinking about this, the problem between accessing both mental health and drug and alcohol services. There's such a disjoint there, and consumers are confused about systems, about how you access both of those systems. And I wondered if there's any thoughts about how we could make that process easier for consumers.
That's a great question. So what is it, and we know in southwestern Pennsylvania, because the Ohio Valley throughout Kentucky, West Virginia, southern Ohio, Pennsylvania, have huge increases in heroin and drug abuse and large numbers of deaths. This year, there'll be 43,000 drug overdose deaths in America, and several more times that will be treated in an emergency room or by police who are giving Narcan. The issue is right now there is a barrier between mental health dollars and substance abuse dollars that go to states that they have to treat them separately. And places like Pennsylvania also have some laws in the book that prevent people from practicing both in this, providing care for both persons at the same time. And yet a majority of people with substance abuse problems have also some mental health dual diagnoses. I believe that it's best to treat both at the same time. So if a person is depressed and taking illicit drugs, we ought to be dealing with the depression and the substance abuse at the same time. So what we want to do is allow states a mechanism where they can braid those funds together for treatment, but not to withdraw it from one. We're not taking substance abuse money away and say you're going to treat for mental health clinics instead, but saying for those that have both, use it for both. We also ask that to the Office of the Assistant Secretary of Mental Health, which my bill creates, that they evaluate, that they gather that information, they present that to states and the federal government, because a lot of that data simply is not out there. And part of that data is also to gather information from the states of what they're doing and what they're spending in the criminal justice system as well as the healthcare system. Because a lot of states aren't even aware that when they thought they could save money by closing down these asylums, and again, they should have closed down the asylums, they thought they were going to save money, but what happens actually is they spent a heck of a lot more money on building jails. So we traded the hospital bed for the jail cell, or the hospital bed we've traded for the homeless shelter or the morgue. We've made it worse for many people, and it's gotten more expensive. So our bill also wants that data tracked and reported so that states and the federal government can be aware not just what those rates are, but we want to know what the best practices are. Who's got some great ideas? Who's doing some important work in this area that other states could use as models?
Thank you for that question, Todd. Let's go to Ozzie in Squirrel Hill. Ozzy, you're on Essential Pittsburgh.
Hi. Thank you so much for this legislation. It sounds amazing. I'm an assistant professor of social work at California University of Pennsylvania, and I was really interested in learning more about workforce development and if that's a part of this, because one of the things about social work is that there's a lot of stigma surrounding our profession, and it can often be hard for us to engage students and get them interested in becoming social workers.
My wife is a social worker, and I know the valuable clinical role that clinical social workers provide in care. A lot of times people think, oh, the social worker, isn't that the person that fills out your welfare forms? No. Clinical social workers are a valuable part of the treatment team. I know in my unit at Walter Reed Hospital Bethesda, we have psychiatrists, psychologists, speech, occupational therapists, social workers, all these people working together as a team to help. What our bill does is we're asking the assistant secretary to actually delve into this area and give us an idea of how many people are needed. We know it's a shortage. We want accurate numbers and where those areas are in the country. In some areas, sadly, it's an urban area that's underserved. Rural areas we know are way underserved. We're also allowing more minority fellowship grants into these areas. And we're always including psychiatrists, psychologists, clinical social workers in these areas for help. I wish I could encourage more and more people to go into that field, but as you know, Ozzy, it just doesn't pay well. And what we are doing is, it's not that we don't spend a lot of money in mental health and the justice system. We spend a massive amount of money, but we're spending it at the wrong end. We should be spending more on early treatment.
Does your legislation, Congressman, address the pay issue? Can pay be increased for the social workers who do this very important work?
Well, it addresses it from the standpoint of they can be paid under circumstances, for example, that same-day doctor rule, the consultation within the practice, or providing more hospital beds. By having more settings, there's places where the people can be paid when they work there. Medicaid, Medicare set some specific rates for providers on that. We don't adjust those rates in this bill. That's another battle with Medicaid and Medicare. But we are looking at ways of building more folks in the workforce, because part of it is there's a shortage. Part of it is that people don't want to seek the field. And those are all problematic. So we're dealing with first the access to the care.
Let's go to Carrie in Regent Square for one more question for Congressman Murphy. Hi, Carrie. Whoop, we lost Carrie. We did have an email question, Congressman, before I let you go, from Eileen, who is asking how many people with mental illness, not just their families, have been a part of putting together your bill?
Well, we've had a lot of families and individuals with mental illness as part of this. We have I've had upwards of 20 hearings around the just in Capitol Hill on these issues, and I've traveled to many states. I have met with many consumers. What I've not done is have them in a more public setting, because I don't want them to be paraded out there and be in situations where they may be more vulnerable and fragile. But talk to many about that. They have had a lot of input along the way, and our bill has actually gone through a couple of major revisions. Our first was introduced in 2014, modified version amended in 2015, and then recently as it moved through the subcommittee with many other amendments. We are welcome to input that helps us come up with perfecting language on this, and we also have places in the laws we're having in terms of those who will continue to make recommendations for areas of research and care. Some of those positions are indeed consumers in the mental health system, and some are family members as well as experts and providers. So we know that all of them are a part of this. But what we want to make sure is we are building strong teams of people on multiple levels here to get care in America changed. Because quite sadly and tragically, care right now tends to come from a policeman or a jail or from ignored by citizens who just walk by and live in this idea we can comfortably abdicate our responsibility to action and live under this perverse redefinition that the most compassionate compassion is to do nothing at all. And I'm not going to tolerate that anymore.
And the last part of Eileen's question was, she wants to know if this bill would decrease community funding for mental health supports.
Absolutely not. No, we would not decrease community health funding. We actually have some incentives in there for states to be doing more, especially for those persons who tend to be just dumped out of jail onto the street. We want them to have follow-up and wraparound services. Working an amendment to that to say that you couldn't even order someone to be in treatment unless that community has the treatment. We know there's a lot more that's needed, and more here will come from some of the grants and the programs within this. But I hope people read up on it. It's on my website, murphy.house.gov. It's the Helping Families in Mental Health Crisis Act, H.R. 2646. It's been supported by American Psychiatric Association, Psychological Association, Social Workers, National Alliance on Mental Illness, Mental Health America, and many, many other organizations in support of this. We welcome people's support and input. Thing is, we've got to pass this bill because whereas Congress deals with a lot of bills and a lot of issues, this is one where we know if you add up the 41,000 suicides this year, the 43,000 drug overdose deaths, the thousands of people who either die from homelessness or the chronic illness that this is associated with mental illness, or those who are victims of crime, or those involved with homicides, we have more deaths this year than the total U.S. combat deaths in the Korean War and the Vietnam Wars combined. 10 people an hour. We can't tolerate that. So it is important to stop delaying this and move this forward and start to reform our and transform our mental health system in America where we can be doing the right kind of services for those most in need.
We've been talking with Tim Murphy, U.S. Congressman for the 18th District of Pennsylvania, about his Helping Families in Mental Health Crisis Act of 2015. And Congressman, we appreciate it. It's been a very enlightening conversation, and thank you so much for being so generous with your time.
Thank you. Have a wonderful day.
Coming up, we'll look at coping mechanisms in the aftermath of violent, tragic events. It's Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA.